She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And fasten your seatbelts, because we are going to have an exciting show and give you a great deal to think about as it relates to the clothes and apparel accessories that you put on your body. Let's do a little shout out to Fairfax Companies, because our show today is made possible due to their generous support. And they are true leaders in the business of sustainability. Since 1989, Fairfax has strived to be a leader in sustainability, and they are truly dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative management and business practices. If you want to know more about them, I invite you to visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. So get ready. The name of our show today is Rethinking Fashion. And I am beyond Thunderdome excited to introduce our guest, Sass Brown. Like, how could we have anything except a great show with someone named Sass? And she is Sass Brown. She's the founder of Eco Fashion Talk. She's an author. She's an editor for Coco Eco, and say that fast three times, Coco Eco Fashion Magazine, and acting associate dean, School of Art and Design, the very, very famous Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. Originally from London, England, which you will hear very on in the conversation, Sass established herself as a designer with her own signature collection, selling in the UK and across Canada. And as a researcher, writer, blogger, I wanted to insert here someone who never sleeps, comma, her area of expertise is eco fashion in all of its different expressions, from slow design, and we're going to find out what that means, and heritage craft skills, to recycle, reuse, and new business models. Sass was also voted in the top 10 women who changed the face of fashion by Fashion Compassion. There's a lot of alliteration going on there, and I love it. Sass, thanks for being here today. And after that long intro, the show is really going to be all about you.
Yikes. Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yes, we'll have some fun. And I always say learning can be fun. So we'll
and it should be.
It should be fun. So it's always
especially
good
when it's related
to this. Yes, it is. It's really good. And so it's always good. I think I should practice my singing and say, let's start at the very beginning, because it's really a good place to start. But how did you get started in the fashion industry? Give us some background on Sass Brown, the parts that you can share with the public.
Sure. Well, I'm a fashion designer trained and have worked in the fashion industry for many, many years. So I did my bachelor's in design back in the UK and started working immediately on graduation within the fashion industry, but not in any ethical space at that time. I'd always had my own personal ethics, so when I came to set up my own company a little later on, I'd always done the things that just seemed to be sensible, and quite honestly a lot of emerging designers do, because they're saving their pennies.
Right.
Whether it's making the most of the fabrics that they use and not wasting, whether it's recycling their paper just because you get horrified by the amount of paper waste you make. It's not, when you think about paper recycling, you tend to think about office paper recycling, but pattern makers, people who are making the paper patterns and the card patterns and the layouts for production
right.
cutting, there's enormous wastage of paper in that. And it's not normally recycled because it's attached to fabric, it's got staples in it, it's not an easy, clean recycle. You don't just roll it up in a ball and throw it into a blue box. So I'd always sort of done those things independently when I had the option, when it was under my control. And it sort of led from there in many ways. I'd always had a preference for natural materials to begin with. But I think like most people that have got into this space, it tended to be a bit of an organic journey. and happened through a number of sort of watershed moments and just general growth and learning and so on. I had been working as, after I had had my own collection for many years, I ended up working back in the industry again for a number of fairly high-profile brands, and just got very disenchanted with the whole sort of hamster on a treadmill of the industry. And by chance picked up a single class teaching at FIT, and it sort of opened a whole world, new world to me at that time, where all the parts of me that weren't particularly appreciated in the corporate fashion world were much more appreciated in the educational sphere, because it was what made me different, made me stand out, and made my experience unique. And so for a number of reasons, I ended up representing the university at a variety of different conferences. One of the very first one, when I was just an adjunct teacher teaching a single class, was in Brazil. And just by chance, again, I happened to pick up an Elle magazine, I think it was at the time, where there was a beautiful article on Carlos Miele, a Brazilian designer who was working with a women's cooperative in the favela, which is the slums in Rio. And I thought, oh, look, I'm going to be in Rio at a conference in a couple of weeks. Let me reach out and see if I can find out more about this, because this sounds really interesting. So the conference organizers were terribly helpful, put me in touch with the designer and put me in touch with the founder of the cooperative. They said, of course we know who you're talking about. They're both quite famous here. And sort of a lot of things grew out of that. I met with the cooperative. I ended up writing a grant, an educational grant, when I returned to New York to spend the next summer there working with the cooperative. I ended up spending the next 5 years of my life, 3 to 4 months a year, going back to the cooperative and volunteering and helping and advising. And that led to other advisement for small SMEs, small medium-sized businesses, or the creative industries, or other women's cooperatives. So a lot of things sort of led to that. And as I said, there's sort of a lot of watershed moments. I ended up taking, again, as an outgrowth of being a teacher, one of the many advantages is access to education.
Right,
so
right.
I ended up taking my master's here at FIT and focused all of my projects, all of my work on ethical fashion. And at the end of that, I had so much material, I decided to publish a book. And so then the publishing and the writing thing sort of came into being. So a whole range of synchronicities, you know, life is strange and wonderful sometimes and takes you all kinds of places you don't necessarily plan to go, but seems that it planned for you to go all along.
It's so the story, Sass. That is so the story. You're telling a beautiful story about how you were literally being prepared for leadership in a very challenging industry at so many levels. So it's a great progressive journey that you shared with us. It's like, yeah. And it's not uncommon with my journey and the guests that I interview where it's, I always think of that book, if you give a mouse a cookie, and then it, you know, then they'll want a glass of milk, and it goes on and on. You just keep wanting to learn more. So that's a wonderful kind of segue into something I want to talk about just briefly. And that is what I call, because I can't come up with a better alliteration, but I call it the filthy fashion industry, because you do have, you're having a tremendous impact on that. But there's a picture we need to paint for our listeners about how big an industry it is, the impact it has on our environment, which that's the, you know, I don't want to vilify anybody or point the bad guy, but it's, we need to talk about it because it highlights the importance of the work you're doing as a leader in the eco-fashion industry. So can you tell us how bad is it? And then we'll go on to the how good is it.
Sure. Yeah, and it is important because it sets up the context
for
why this is important. So as much as, you know, nobody wants to, well, actually some people do want to point the finger, and I prefer to talk about, you know, the things that are being done that are making changes and making difference, but the context is, why is it important? And there are lots of really scary issues, and one of the challenges with fashion is it's a fun, cool, aspirational industry that people, you know, that's glamorous and
get people get excited about it. Yes,
absolutely, which is part of what gives it a great ability to make change in how we do business, how we consume, how we do a lot of things. But it's also what glosses over the fact that there's a really dirty underbelly to all of this. There are people and planet that suffer through the production of our clothing. And the reality is that, you know, if everybody out there knew all of the issues that there are with producing cheap clothing, that I don't think anybody would want to purchase something if the hang tag said this was made at the cost of another human life, or this was made at the cost of polluting a pristine waterway, or, you know, or poisoning fish, or any number of different issues. And the reality is that textile manufacturing and garment production does do all of that. And the chances are the cheaper the piece of clothing, whether it's a fashionable piece of clothing or it's not, has been done taking advantage of that. We call it the hidden price tag, because it's not the price you pay at the counter when you're buying the t-shirt or the jeans or whatever it is, but it's the price that some other human beings are paying for its manufacture, or it's the price that the planet is paying in terms of pollution to make that piece available at that price. A $5 t-shirt, a $10, $15 pair of jeans cannot be made with good conscience, taking care of people and planet at that price point. It simply can't. Something has to suffer. And it may not be you at the counter, but it is the environment, or it is the makers, or it's the growers, or it's something along those lines.
And, you know,
that's the reality of it. No, it's that's just the reality of it. I mean, there are four major impacts in garment production. One is raw materials. It doesn't matter whether it's natural or it's synthetic. They all have an impact, whether they're mined, whether they're grown. It's the manufacturing, whether of the textiles or the garment or both. And then it's the shipment. That's something that a lot of people don't think about. You know, most garments, especially if you're talking mass production, they're sourced in one place and produced in another, or actually different parts of the production are produced in many places. So the fiber may come from one place. It may be ginned or spun or woven or whatever in another place. It may be cut and made in a third. It may be transported and warehoused in another and then retailed in another. So it might have gone round the globe several times by that stage. So CO2 emissions are huge in comparison to, you know, the actual cost of a material or the cost of the t-shirt or whatever. And then finally, consumer care, which actually is a massive contributor to energy use, the washing, the dry cleaning of clothes.
Right. And the numbers and the size of the industry, I think I told you that we had Scott and Matt from Indigenous on a couple of weeks ago. And $2.5 trillion industry. I mean, we're not talking about a small industry. And, you know, you and I spoke very briefly, but it brings to light the social justice issues, because 80% of the workers are women, and therefore keeping that great divide going, and children. And, you know, like you said, you touched on everything, the water use, it's the second highest industrial polluter. Fashion, second highest industrial polluter. So you have a big job, Miss Sass Brown.
And the second global user of water.
Second global user of water.
Second largest user. The first one is agriculture. The second is textile and garment production. So pollution and water use, two of the most critical issues that, you know, we are dealing with as a planet, as people. I mean, the water, what they call the water footprint for production of garments is quite often huge. It takes somewhere in the region of 2,000 to 3,000 liters of water to make a T-shirt. A T-shirt that you might buy for a couple of dollars in a store, 2,000 to 3,000 liters of water. Now, the water footprint talks about, you know, it takes into account the water that was utilized to grow the fiber, assuming the T-shirt was cotton or a blend thereof. It considers the washing of it afterwards. So we're talking about not just the fiber here, but nevertheless, that's enormous. A pair of jeans is considered between 10 and 12,000 liters of water.
Unreal.
To make a single pair of jeans. It's mind-boggling, the figures. And when you think that there are over a billion people globally who don't have access to clean, safe drinking water, and the estimates are by 2025 that 2 out of 3 people in the world will live in water-stressed areas, and that includes the U.S.
It's just like, I want to ask everybody who's listening, just press pause and let some of that sink in, because I was that person that used to buy, oh, it's St. Patrick's Day. Let's get everybody in the family a $5 T-shirt at Target with a shamrock on it. 4th of July, you know, oh, it's only $5. And now I look at them, and I'm not going to say what I think, but they're never coming home to our house again unless I get them in a Goodwill, because then, like, the guilt is transferred to whoever bought that first.
Yeah, it's shocking.
It is very, very devastating.
I think if clothing came with a warning, like cigarettes have on the back of the cigarette packet.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yes.
This $5 T-shirt came at the cost of, you know, this poor young woman who was producing it, or this farmer that was exposed to all these pesticides, or, you know, any number of things. I think everyone would look at it horrified, and we'd end cheap clothing consumption instantaneously.
Oh, it would be that, keep holding that dream. And it, you could say people have been harmed in the making of this article of clothing. Mm-hmm. Just say that. So let's do a little bit of definitions, because you're an expert. So is there a difference between eco-fashion, ethical fashion, sustainable fashion, like those three? Are they all, you know, I mean, I think I know what ethical fashion is, and no, people were harmed. But does eco-fashion cover the definition of what it means to you and to people in the industry to be a representative and a leader for eco-fashion?
Well, you know, there's a lot of change in terms. What's current, what's used, what's overused. It's like any words in the English language, or I guess any language, you know, the connotations change a little bit over time dependent upon their use and who uses them and how they're used. Eco-fashion is a term that it's sort of gone a bit out of fashion for a number of reasons. It doesn't really have a terribly definable definition to it. So because of that, it was one of the first terms to be used by people who were greenwashing and didn't really have a great deal of sincerity when they were talking about what they did.
Wow.
So simply because it's not terribly definable. I mean, it comes from ecology, obviously, and there is a meaning to ecology. Sustainability, on the other hand, really does have a very definable terminology, and it basically means that whatever you are doing, whether it's producing a T-shirt, that you are not consuming and polluting in the process of doing so. You are not leaving less resources than when you began the process with, whether those are human resources or whether those are ecological resources or planetary resources. So that does have a pretty definable terminology. But it's not so much of an easy word to bandy around, sustainability.
Right.
So ethics, of course, pertains specifically more to the human content than anything, because you're talking about the ethics of how you do business. That does, of course, pertain to carbon footprint or water use or pollution as well. But it does particularly pertain to human rights and fair trade in many ways. And everybody has, you know, their own version of what that means to them personally. But there are some defined connotations towards specifically ethics and more specifically sustainability.
And if you take the time to think about it, the word sustainability is so much more encompassing, all-encompassing, and it brings to light that means the fashion will last and be sustainable. The seams mm-hmm. won't be. So there's that piece, and then all of the other yeah. integration of thought with that. We are up on our first break. I cannot believe it. Everybody stay here wow. with me. Sass Brown from the Fashion Institute of Technology with lots more to talk about in terms of trends, perspectives, and all that's sustainable in fashion. Stay here with me.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we are certainly inviting all of our listeners to start really thinking about sustainable fashion, how it impacts your life, how it impacts the planet, and what you can do to show up as someone who's decided to make a difference. Just another quick shout out to the Fairfax companies for helping make this show possible. And I again invite you to visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com if you want to learn more about a great company. The name of our show today is Rethinking Fashion. With us for this hour is someone who continues to revolutionize the fashion industry, and she is all that. Please join me once again in welcoming the founder of Eco Fashion Talk, author, editor for Eco Fashion Magazine, and acting associate dean, School of Art and Design, Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City, the one and only Sass Brown. So Sass, hi. Again, thanks for being with us. Let's talk a little bit about, if there's anything left on that, I always like to do a smooth segue here. If you had any thoughts in that 30-second break that you'd like to add, please do.
I think we covered quite a bit of ground there.
Really, really good stuff. Like, really good stuff. And I agree with you that eco fashion can be just a trendy little thing, but where if people want to take the time to think, sustainable fashion is a much more deeply rooted in change concept. So What about the overall fashion industry in general as it relates to sustainability and a healthy planet? What are some of the biggest issues that are of interest to you? You know, your thoughts on, you've been doing this a while. Are you seeing exciting trends? So give us your perspective of where is the fashion industry?
I think we've made huge strides, actually, and I think there's a lot more to go. But I think it's really encouraging what we're seeing. Kering Brands, of course, one of the largest luxury brand owners in the world, in the last year have started doing environmental impact accounting. So the impact of the production of all of their brands. They have a new collaboration with the Centre for Sustainable Fashion at the London College of Fashion in the UK. So I think that's incredibly encouraging because luxury fashion had sort of been a bit sidelined for a while. And although that is, you know, a particular niche market, certainly we're not, the vast majority of consumers aren't there, aren't luxury consumers, but we're in an industry that often trickles down from the luxury industry to the other layers and the other levels. So that's hugely important that luxury brands would take a stand in that way. You've got, you know, obviously undertakings like H&M and their Conscious Collection, which they've been doing for a number of years. They're a partner in an undertaking called the Mistra Project, which is also out of the UK and is a collaboration multi-stakeholder research.
I just want to ask you a question about H&M, because that's a really, it's a good example, because they do have, and I would really like to give some time later on in the interview about the issue of affordability for the masses. But if in this particular case, I have read about the H&M collection. I have seen it at the store here in Tucson. Does it get the Sass Brown endorsement, so if you go in there, it's not greenwashing? You can feel really good and comfortable about buying, you know, ethical clothing, which I call it, at H&M?
It's an alternative, you know. I think part of the challenge with all of this these conversations is there is no perfect Nirvana brand.
No silver bullet.
There just isn't. No, I mean, there are companies that have got as close as they can, such as, say, a Patagonia or an EcoAlf, that are really very dedicated. But there's no such thing as perfection at this stage. You know, everybody's striving to do better. In the mass market, there are way more challenges than there are probably in any other arena of fashion. Simply, if nothing else, because of the huge scale we're talking about. So is what H&M's doing with the Conscious Collection worthwhile? Absolutely it is. Does it offset their global expansion and their CO2 emissions and their all of the other things that they do, whether that how much they're paying for the production of their garments? Absolutely no, it doesn't. So no, I wouldn't necessarily go as far as saying it gets my stamp of approval. I think what they're doing is wonderful. I think it's important. Ultimately, fast fashion and cheap clothing is not the answer.
Right.
That said, it can be an interim point of them becoming more sustainable, but ultimately more conscious and fewer purchases are the ultimate answer, not more conscious as many purchases.
You know, I've been talking about this. I get on these. I'm so manic about this stuff in a very good way. It's like we have got to really, I want to be a leading voice in changing the conversation about fashion through my shows and having guests like you that really break it down as to why we should care, why a mom should care. Because, you know, even the putting on of clothing and what it's treated with and what kind of health impact it can have. Is one of the answers very hard for the American consumer? Does it come down to something as simple as buying really good clothing and doing and getting by with a lot less of it? Is that one of the solutions? To me, and I'm going to be honest about my opinion, our massive consumption mindset is one of the biggest problems. We're massively consuming. And, you know, I just got rid of 6 bags of stuff for a Goodwill collection, and it didn't make a dent. So I'm not casting stones. I'm rethinking what are my patterns? Do I need 4 pairs of black shoes? Now, that's a tough subject. Yes, I probably do. Don't take away my shoes. Please don't. But, you know, there's a whole deeper conversation about changing the way we approach consumption. Is that, am I onto something here, Sass Brown?
Oh, no. Absolutely. That's absolutely vital. The challenge is you're talking about a culture shift.
Yes.
People that grow up or learn to have learned over the decades and had cheap access to clothing aren't about to give it up very quickly and very willingly. So it does require a culture shift. But it is absolutely the answer. We cannot consume at this rate. As other nations and other countries in the developing world, more and more of them are reaching middle class and their consumption goes up and up. We simply don't have the resources. for ourselves to continue at this rate of consumption, never mind have new people and new generations also consuming at the same or greater rate. It's not sustainable. It simply isn't. We don't have the resources to produce that in the long run. We don't have the resources to maintain that. We don't have the resources to dispose of that when they've reached the end of their life. So that has to change. And that will be forced upon us with resource shortages at some stage. When you start talking about, you know, land use and is it better to grow a crop because there are so many people hungry in the world, or is it better to grow a fiber? And do we already have enough garments that
right,
made
right.
already that we can use? Or is it better to use the water in agriculture, in growing crops, or to grow, again, fibers? Or are we polluting the planet and or coming to an end of our petroleum resources, which, of course, is what most synthetic fibers are made out of? Is it more important to use petroleum as energy or to make another polyester T-shirt?
Right, right. To stack in your drawer.
So, you know, there will be resource, more and more resource shortages and restrictions, and by default, that will affect the cost. So some of this will be forced upon us sooner or later. Hopefully there will be many, many technological discoveries and things going on that will help mitigate a lot of that. But nevertheless, at this rate, with this planet and our current capabilities, we've really already outgrown it. So yes, we do have to become much smarter consumers. We do have to invest in clothing. We need to reconnect, quite honestly, in my mind, with what it means to us. You know, we've got to thinking with fast fashion in particular, or cheap clothing in general, that clothing is a form of entertainment as opposed to something that you invest in. You invest your money, your energy, and your love into, and it's something you want to care for and keep and share and use. You know, it's become a bit more like the Chinese takeaway. You consume it by wearing it once to a particular event, and then you throw it away the next day without a thought because it didn't cost you any more than the pizza or the Chinese takeout.
I know, that's so awful, but it's so true. And I'm just going to, like, I want a hashtag culture shift. You're talking about that's the toughest one. That's for all of us. So let me ask, I have a global perspective person on the show, and I love this. You walk in many cultures. When I lived in Germany decades ago and traveled, mm-hmm. you know, in Europe, the people mm-hmm. in Germany, like, seriously, they had 5 really good outfits. They mm-hmm. would air them. You're not talking going to the dry cleaners every 5 minutes. Yep. Outside mm-hmm. on Saturdays, you'd see them out in their windows. And mm-hmm. I know that when I visited France, talk about fashion mavens, but they bought mm-hmm. little quality, you know, not, they didn't have 4 closets full. How is that mm-hmm. now?
It's changed all over the world. Certainly, some parts of Europe have a particular heritage in the sort of cultural understanding that clothing is an investment. You buy the best you can so it'll last as long as it can. But if you think historically, not specific to any culture, if you think of your mother's generation or your grandmother's generation,
right.
My mother's generation bought a coat that would cost her 3 months' wages and would have to last her at least 10 or 12 years.
I was going to say 10 years. Yes, and that's what we
that's
got.
What
I got my
cost.
Sister's. mm-hmm. If you were the second
because
daughter,
that's what a coat.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's what things cost, you know. So given those sort of, you know, financial restraints, that's simply what you had to do. So people did buy and did invest in something that had to last.
And it was a darn good coat, which we need to add.
Mm-hmm.
It was a coat that would last
Absolutely.
10 years, which is different now.
Absolutely. And if you take the, you know, the historical lens even further back, if you think about you know, fashion fads. There have always been fashion fads, but if you go back to the sort of 16, 17, 1800s, where you're talking about the royal courts around the world were the ones that established a particular fashion. And those fashion trends were in place for hundreds of years before they changed. And then they came down to maybe just a generation, and then maybe just a particular reign. You know, so as technology has become quicker and more efficient, it's allowed, you know, cheaper access to materials and more consumption. And that is just as valid for your washing machine as it is your clothing or your sewing machine. I mean, my grandmother had a sewing machine that lasted her entire life. And, you know, the cheap little domestic ones you get now don't do the same thing at all. So
you're so right. My mother's sewing machine, it was heavy metal, not the band.
They were cast iron.
It was cast iron. Yes.
They weighed tons. Yes. Nothing could go wrong with them. They were simple. They were basic. They did the job.
Yes.
You could throw them out the window, pick them up again, and they'd still be working just fine.
It's so true. And again, that's a whole nother rabbit hole of waste and disposability. Just, we'll get a new one and throw the old one in the garbage. Let's trash it.
And it relates to price. If it's that cheap, then it becomes disposable by default. So when clothing isn't that cheap, it is no longer disposable because you've had to invest more of a significant portion of your income on it. Therefore, by default, it has a greater value to you in financial terms alone.
It's huge.
Never mind the emotion
and
the time you've invested making the right choice as opposed to going, oh, that's cute, I'll grab it, it's only $5.
Right, and I think about, I am obsessed with the whole movement to tiny homes, and I just look at them and I say, oh my gosh, we could do that. And my husband says, no, you could not do that. Because it is part of that whole, like I say, the rabbit hole where, no, I couldn't because my closet would fill up a tiny home, so I'd have to really rethink so many, talk about cultural shifts. I would be on some type of really bad medication for the transition. It's like, calm me down. But it is that. It's a great metaphor for, you know, reducing our impact and living with less and loving it. You know what I mean? So we're not here to talk about tiny homes. We're here to talk about the fashion industry. So we have a break coming up in about 4 minutes, and this answer might take you 4 minutes. But I'm very curious to know, what would you say, you, Sass Brown, say to a mother who said to you, I really do care. I don't want the blood of women and children on my T-shirts for my kids. I'm a stay-home mom. We have one income, which already you're blessed if you have an income person that, you know, lets you stay home. But I care. How can I afford sustainable clothing? What's your advice to me, Sass Brown?
I think there are options, and we're in a really good place that there are a number of options at a number of price points. So in an instance like that, yes, H&M is an option, as is upcycling and freecycling. There are tons of freecycling groups around. There is vintage. There are great parties with freecycling parties.
Yes.
The amount of events I go to these days that say, bring 5 items, take 5 items.
Oh, I love it.
And they've been great stuff, not, you know, things you wouldn't want.
Right, stuff you wanted to buy in the first place.
Yeah. I think there are lots of options, but particularly for a mother, I mean, if you're talking about your children, you know, especially young children that are growing out of clothing at a tremendous rate, one of the things that I think should impact and does impact them quite significantly is the Greenpeace detox campaign. The number of chemicals that go into modern clothing, and particularly children's clothing. And, you know, this is something that just simply isn't discussed enough. Our skin is the single largest organ of the human body, and it doesn't just excrete sweat, it absorbs as well. And there are commonly 2,000 to 3,000 chemicals utilized in the dyeing, finishing, and processing of textiles, at least half a dozen of which are known carcinogens on the EPA.
2,000 to 3,000?
Not on every piece of textiles.
But
I just mean they're common chemicals utilized.
Oh.
Yes. huge numbers of chemicals. We're talking about the chemical use in the dyeing, finishing, printing industry is enormous. Many of those chemicals are banned in the countries where we buy our clothing, but they're not banned in the countries where our clothing is produced.
And it's when you talk about it, it's that collective impact. And I, you know, my background is in the social service industry, and I just watched autism increase and ADD increase and ADHD increase and all kinds of mental health problems.
Allergies,
asthma. I mean, the list goes on, and it's toxins in our environment. And the thing about clothing that's so awful next to skincare, it's what we put on our bodies. It's on our sheets, on our pillows. Everything we touch, we have to watch it. So the big shocker here is we have 1 minute till the next break. I've got two more pages of questions, so I'm going to fire through the questions in the next part of it. But everybody, stay here with me. And Sass, when we come back, I'd love you to talk a little bit about your role as the Associate Dean at the School of Art and Design. And I want to hear, what are the great minds saying? Where are they? Are they caring about getting on Project Runway, or are they caring about getting on Project Eco Fashion Sustainability? We'll come up with something hot for that. Everybody, stay here with me. The one and only Sass Brown. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. And I want to just ask you to press pause for a minute. Hopefully some of you listened to that request for sustainers. And if we are to become the NPR or the PBS of green, we need your support, just like PBS and just like NPR. So consider becoming a sustainable member of the Mrs. Green's World movement. We'd appreciate your support. The name of our show today is Rethinking Fashion, and Are We Ever? Please join me once again in welcoming Sass Brown, the founder of Eco Fashion Talk, author, editor for Coco Eco Fashion Magazine, acting associate dean, School of Art and Design, Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. And of among her many accomplishments, she was voted in the top 10 women who changed the face of fashion. And I say that with such passion on my part, by an organization called Fashion Compassion. She is all that. Sass Brown, thanks for being with us.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm so glad I have someone who's waving arms at me saying we're ready for another break, because I would just talk right over it. It would be like, okay, there's more good stuff to share here. So I'd like to talk about, and you get to choose first, what about your books? Because I don't want the time to go by and you don't get a chance to talk about those, because I spent a lot of time looking at those. And maybe then we could talk about the what's going on at FIT. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about your books, which the first one, Eco Fashion, you published in 2010. And there's some things that I'd like you to talk about in particular. The production of desirable and well-designed apparel and accessories with a conscience. What is an article of clothing or an accessory with a conscience? And I think you've kind of answered that, but tell us about the book.
The book sort of grew out of doing my master's in many ways. I just had all of this information, and I started the website and the blog as a means of sharing the information. And I wrote it because at the time there really wasn't enough information out there, whether you were a student, whether you were a designer, whether you were a consumer. There were some great books that were already out, but they tended to be about ethical design in general. So you'd get, you know, a really great upcycled desk featured in a book next to an organic beige T-shirt. So there wasn't the focus on design, and there wasn't a particular focus on fashion in and of its own right. It was just sort of lumped in with ethical design at the time. And so I, you know, being a long diehard fashionista myself and a designer by trade, I thought we deserved our own book.
And so you wrote it.
And so I wrote it, yes. And I also felt that, you know, the books that were out there at that time that were focusing on, as I said, most of them were focusing either on design or on lifestyle, you know, how to reduce your carbon footprint in general, which included clothing. But often very much of it was, you know, what do you do with a stained T-shirt? How do you upcycle it and reuse it and make it into a grocery bag? And as useful as all of that information is, I'm a fashion snob, you know.
Just so anybody, I'm telling you, go to her website and you'll see. I mean, we're talking hot chick here. Let's be honest. This is a hot chick.
But fashion is about aspiration. It's about excitement. It's about sex. It's about cuteness. It's about so many different things. And what wasn't being included in that conversation at that time was the design aspect. It was all about how ethical it was. And in this time period, that simply isn't enough of a hook. People will not buy clothing if it's ugly just because it does good.
Right. Thank you. I don't want to look ugly and have my conscience be clear.
I just felt it was really important to write about cool kick-ass clothing that also was good for the planet.
Perfect.
So
cool kick-ass
clothing.
That's
where the book came from.
Another hashtag,
yep.
Cool kick-ass clothing. I mean, it's so sad that at 65 years old, I think in hashtag. Some people say to me, my eyes are like, what's a hashtag? I say, well, here's the deal. I think in hashtags.
Nothing wrong with that. You're keeping up with the time.
Nothing wrong with that.
But I think it's vital, you know, all ethical design has to be well designed first. People need to desire things to purchase them, and especially if you're asking them to pay more and invest in them and keep them and care for them. They've got to love them to begin with, so they better be well designed. They better fit well. They better be out of good fabrics. So inevitably, a lot of the designers I write about tend to be in higher price points. They're not mass. But I don't exclusively write about that. But I do write about aspirational fashion. There are lots of versions of it that are more accessible financially. But that was the impetus behind writing the book. And it didn't matter if you were a consumer or if you were a designer or what you were, everyone is connected to clothing in some way, shape, or form, and fashion is, you know, a great leveler. Everyone, because they wear clothing, has an opinion and cares about it on some level, or hates it, vilifies it, but either way is connected. So it just seemed like the time was overdue for a book that talked about ethical fashion, with the fashion being equal to the ethics.
Yes, I love it. I love it. And then the second book, which is, to me, speaks volumes about the affordability factor, is
Absolutely.
Refashioned, cutting-edge mm-hmm. clothing yep. from upcycled materials. And this is one where, you know, I used to sew, so I know it's possible. But just looking mm-hmm. at that book, if you have a creative bone in your body, and I, in particular, have a really good friend who is a master seamstress, she
Perfect.
Upcycles my things, some of which I Brilliant. Give her and she wears, and some of which she changes and makes them modern and gives them back to me. So that's
Brilliant.
Affordable. So talk about that book and upcycled materials. What does that mean? Tell people what that means.
Upcycling just simply means taking something that's undervalued or has no particular value and giving it value back again. So, for example, a damaged or stained piece of clothing, in and of itself, it's pretty worthless. You're not going to wear it again. It has a hole in it or has a stain on it, so it doesn't have any significant value anymore. But if you take that piece of clothing, recut it, re-embellish it, redesign it, and make it something desirable again, then you have increased its value. So it's recycling, but it's upcycling. It's taking it up the scale as opposed to down, because there's also downcycling. You know, you could also use it as a rag to clean your floor with. It's not going to last terribly much longer, and you're making it of even lesser value than what it originally was, which was a stained piece of clothing. So they're the different sides of a scale, if you like. The piece of clothing in the middle, you upcycle it, make it of greater value. You downcycle it, make it of lesser value.
And, you know, Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was talking to somebody today and in preparation for the show and how excited I was about it. And we got in this long conversation about her husband. They're talking about getting on the trend of, this is so exciting to me, and I'm not going to steal her idea, but her husband is going to launch a website where it's going to be secondhand clothing, but he will put together the outfits for you. So it's not going to be just a jean. So it's eco-fashion design, where he will put together tell me your size, he'll go and go to the thrift stores and say, this size jacket, put it together with a scarf. He's got an eye for fashion. She was a little doll. So that's another trend that, to me, was positive about this. Absolutely. Is a place where it can go. So recycle and upcycle. Okay, go ahead.
There are great things happening. You know, there are fashion libraries open. Lena is a fashion library. I want to say Denmark, but my memory may not be maybe failing me there, but it's in that area of the world. And they are looking to expand, which is a fashion library. You go and you have a library membership, and you check clothing out, and
you're
you return
kidding.
It. And, you know, these are trends, whether it's that particular one or other ones that are happening. There are websites where you can purchase clothing for digital dollars, so you rarely actually pay for anything other than shipping. Somebody doesn't want it anymore, they put it up on the website, you decide you want it, you have so many credits, you buy it with your credits, it gets shipped to you, you can send it back and put it back there again for sale. So all of these swapping websites, these resale websites, you've got
rent a dress.
Runway, you've got renting clothing. So there are lots and more options all the time that are happening that are just fabulous. And, you know, I mean, particularly vintage clothing has always had its sort of it's always been a cool thing to do for certain people to begin with, getting particular looks, and, you know, so that's another area in and of itself, some of it particularly trendy.
So, and we have to get that good news out there. It's like you and I talked about, we don't want to vilify anyone and talk about how bad it is. Let's start putting a lot of wind in the sails of these great alternatives that are really micro businesses in many cases, you know, the small business owners, where it doesn't take, you know, $250,000 to launch your fashion line. It's a very different paradigm. What about SAS? What do you mean when you say the ultimate expression of the slow fashion movement? Tell us what the slow fashion movement is.
Well, slow fashion is really just fashion that is produced in a more conscious and a slow way. So it tends to be handmade. That doesn't mean hand sewn necessarily, but, you know, a garment that's made from beginning to end by a designer maker, as opposed to something that's outsourced with, you know, 20 different people who have done a very small single process within the production. So they've sewn the buttonhole, or they've put the collar on, whatever, which is the main production methodology for mass production. So somebody who's made it from beginning to end, who's designed it, cut it, sewn it, or that has other hand processes in it. Maybe it's embroidered, maybe it's hand woven, maybe it's hand knitted. They're all expressions of slow fashion because the process is much slower, takes longer, and therefore has more of an investment in it. So it may be a small emerging designer, it may be something that's native or indigenous, it may be something that's local, or it could be something that's come from a global artisan, but has been done in traditional methodologies. So it tends to be more traditional as opposed to be more mechanized, but often involves handwork in some way, shape, or form.
Got it. Got it. So there's fast fashion, and then there's the slow fashion movement. It's like, I mean, it's really true. It makes so much sense. So talk about, and before I forget, I want to tell you that I didn't meet you, but you were on stage when I was at the Fashion Institute. There was an event that was done in conjunction with a green organization, and mm-hmm. You did a presentation. Marcy Zaroff was there, and Mrs. Okay. Green's World had a booth, and you had too big of a line to get to, and I got to Marcy Zaroff, and we had her on the show. But it's like it comes full circle, and I'm hoping that I will come out in April if you let outsiders into your conference in on sustainability and fashion in April that FIT is going to do. So I hope
Sure.
I hope I'm giving you a big hug in a couple of months in my favorite city. So anyway,
I will look forward to that. There are so many great things going on, whether at FIT or other locations. You know, the sustainability conference at FIT. We have a conference on sustainable fashion and textiles in July. We have the Hand of Fashion, which is actually something that is completely free and open to the public, which is a lecture series in collaboration with the Ethical Fashion Initiative, which is an arm of the UN, which is absolutely doing phenomenal work, particularly in Africa, but also in Haiti, with artisans and connecting them to luxury designers. So Burkina Faso weavers with Stella John in Italy, for example, or printers and bag makers with Vivienne Westwood in Ethiopia, and so on. So they're doing magnificent work, and we have FIT have a series of 7 lectures still to go on that. So, and they're open to the public. It's on the website, and it's called Hand of Fashion, and they are free, open to the public, and absolutely amazing.
And are people coming like crazy? I mean, there's good things happening, and is it creating excitement? Because that's the organic shift that you're talking about, the viral mm-hmm. growth of change and culture shifts.
You know, this is where an institution such as FIT or any number of other institutions, whether governmental like the EDC or whether other universities or other spaces like Manufacture New York or the Brooklyn Accelerator, help to get the word out.
Yes.
One of the challenges for those of us that are writers and speakers in this space, in the ethical fashion spaces, the people that tend to come to our book signings, our panels, our discussions, tend to be people who already have an interest. To a degree, we're preaching to the converted.
Got it. I got it. How do we expand that to the masses? Yes, I got it. Got it.
That's a real challenge because, you know, to find out about the book signings or another launch or another panel, they're probably following you on some level anyway, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, to know about it. So the backing of institutions, educational, governmental, non-governmental, private industry is absolutely vital in reaching different people and different consumers, just getting the word out, because they have a much greater reach than any one of us as individuals do. So
right.
What you're doing too, you know, all of that is reaching new people.
That's really important. It's so true. We all have to be pulling in that direction and getting excited about it. And I want to make sure that we tell everyone, especially people that are interested in design in any way, your website is Eco Fashion Talk, and it's a beautiful website telling the stories of our material connection to our world through cutting-edge design. It's a beautiful website. You want to go in. It invites you in. There's videos. There's, you know, really, really beautiful stuff. Follow you on Facebook, Eco Fashion Talk. Of course, you're on Twitter, Eco Fashion Talk, mm-hmm. and Instagram, which has become my personal favorite social media. I'm an Instagrammer. I can tell you that. So what else do you want to say? You have 2 minutes and it can be all yours.
I think it's just, you know, I'm passionate about this. I think it's vital that we all take it upon ourselves to educate ourselves and to continue to educate ourselves. And I'm happy to be part of that conversation. The website's set up so that it's easy access, it's informative, hopefully it's fun, it's visually stimulating. You can do quick searches on designers. You can find out about articles from other resources and that are making a difference or just promoting other design work. But for me, it's all about design. It's about supporting local. It's about supporting artisanship. It's about making conscious choices and having fun with it, enjoying it and sharing that information and understanding that you can be the change that you want to see in the world.
Oh,
and it
gosh,
starts
yes.
with you.
Yes, and go see it, everybody. Take a look. It's, again, ecofashiontalk.com. And the call to action is do one thing. Go to Sass's website. Buy her book. Start training yourself to rethink how much you're consuming. There are lots of takeaways. Find one that fits for you. Sass Brown, thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Our paths will cross. And next week, everybody, we have another exciting show. We're going back to the farm. And we'll have, I have to find my notes here really quick, but Greg, where do I have it? Jean Bauer, co-founder of Farm Sanctuary. Okay, Sass, we went down right to the wire. Thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Okay.
Such a pleasure. Thank you so much. If there's a link or a podcast or anything that
we'll
I can
get it
share,
to you. We will get
terrific.
It to you. I promise. Okay,
love
thanks.
It. Such a pleasure.